Hello, I'm Dr. Eric Topol, editor-in-chief of Medscape, and I've got with me Dr. George Lundberg, who was the other former editor-in-chief of Medscape.
That's true.
And we're going to get into a discussion about George's very interesting career and the contributions he's made, which have really been quite extraordinary in medicine today. I thought I'd start off, George, but you, I guess, grew up in Florida and Alabama, is that right?
I was born in Pensacola, Florida, yeah. But I grew up in L.A., which we call Lower Alabama.
Okay.
And that, I lived there, and that's still, it was home place, but I rarely get back there.
Right.
But it's true.
And then you went on to become a pathologist.
It's true. After college in Chicago and college in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and medical school in Birmingham, and then internship in Hawaii, an Army career of 11 years, which included my residency in San Antonio to become a pathologist, board certified in anatomic and clinical pathology, and later board eligible in forensic path.
And I know you were at both, you had two faculty major positions, one, I guess, at USC, and then later at UC Irvine, is that right?
Close.
Or UC Davis, I mean.
Right, yeah. My first faculty position was at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, where I grew to be a full professor, and I basically ran the labs at the LA County USC Medical Center for nearly 10 years. Then I went to Davis as chair of pathology,
right. And
I was there for 5 years.
Okay, and then all this sets the stage that somewhere along the line you become editor-in-chief of JAMA.
How on earth could that happen?
How did that happen?
Well, it happened. You know, everything in life is chance, accident. Some of its purpose, usually just timing happens and things kind of fit. And you brought up the Florida-Alabama thing. It turned out that the CEO of the AMA at that time was from Alabama, and the COO was from Florida. And so they were looking for an editor at JAMA, and I had been on the board, the editorial board, for several years.
Right.
Bob Mosier had put me there back before he went to become the top guy at the American College of Physicians, and they looked at the board, and I had done a lot of stuff with JAMA already, and they said, well, we'll interview you, and so they did. We interviewed at the Bistro in Beverly Hills. They were going to see Ronald Reagan the next day. This is all
not
true.
To be the JAMA editor.
Yeah, so then they offered me the position, and I said, why would I leave California and go back to Chicago
right.
in the middle of winter?
Did you ever think you'd be an editor like that?
I don't think about things like that. You can't really plot your course. I mean, you've done all kinds of stuff, and I knew I was going to write. My mother wrote a lot for little local newspapers in Lower Alabama, mm-hmm. and so I started writing at a very early age. But editing, I'd been on editorial boards, so I saw how that worked, and
right.
I watched how that worked. So yes, kind of yes and kind of no, but editor, most people don't understand what editor is. They think you've got a pencil and you go out there and do that, and that's part of it. But mostly if you have a big journal, you're managing high-level academic professionals, and you're doing strategic planning, recruiting, you're doing public relations.
And you're trying to build
the journal. You build it.
And you did that at JAMA. I mean,
some people think so.
17 years you were the editor.
17 years.
Isn't that the longest any editor of JAMA ever?
No. The first editor of JAMA... Well, that's not actually right. An early editor named George Simmons lasted 25 years.
Oh, wow.
That was from like 1900 to 1925. And he may have been the best one because he created all those new AMA specialty journals.
Okay.
Those were his babies. And
okay.
then you fast forward to Morris Fishbein, a name that's very familiar in medicine. And he lasted for 25 years as well.
Oh, wow. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, so I'm Simmons retired of his own volition at a time that he chose, and they gave him a party. Fishbein was fired by the House of Delegates. It took years to do it because he was really powerful, but he was fired. But then I was 17 years, so that's the third longest since 1883.
That's pretty impressive. That's a tenure that I think was marked by a big jump in JAMA's impact. Not just impact factor, but impact worldwide in terms of you brought a lot of extra stuff and enriched the journal, as I remember sending articles for you.
Well, you helped. You and thousands of other people who managed to decide to send their best stuff to JAMA, which prior to the 80s hadn't been happening very often. since the 40s. Up to the 40s and early 50s, it was happening. JAMA was the journal of choice for most good stuff. But then New England came and got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the JAMA kind of didn't just kind of lolled around. It was still a good journal, but it didn't really compete. And so I decided in 1982, with the agreement of the AMA, that we would make a run at trying to be the best, and we developed important strategic plans about how to do that. And we were able, over years, it took a long time, to gradually implement many elements of the strategic plan, and the results were highly favorable. These results continue today.
What do you think the biggest parts of that success story?
Oh, my.
I know you've never been afraid of controversy. Was that bringing that in?
Well, obviously, timing, controversy matter. But being scientifically sound matters more. And getting the best papers which will stand up to post-publication peer review is the most important thing that a journal editor and all the staff can do. Mm. But I think of the most important things, we were able to create relationships with the best academic medical centers. And we did that by being friendly with them, by creating editorial board members from them, and then putting our specialty journal editors, who are also on the JAMA board, selecting them from the cream of the crop at the best places. Mm-hmm. So you'd have the editor of the archives of this, the archives of that, from the best places. And then they could start bringing the best stuff to their journal and the JAMA at the same time. So I think those kind of inroads. In addition, I was able to hire part-time editors who were professors at the best places. And they then became our sponge, our attract, our magnet to the best papers from the best places, because I had people that I paid who actually worked at places like Harvard and Hopkins and UCSF and places like
that. So that networking that you were able to do
was a large part of it. But then we had some big hits. And we figured that prior to that, when I was chair at Davis, if a newspaper would contact somebody, the doctors would run away. They wanted no publicity at all. Television cameras lock the door. I said, this is wrong. We need to cultivate the public media as our colleagues to educate the public about its health.
Yeah, that was a whole new look, wasn't it?
A whole new look. Yeah. And we wanted to take that whole thing off and make us colleagues. So we did the press releases every week, the best stuff, and we measured how many times did we get in the New York Times, AP releases, CBS Evening News, that kind of stuff. And it grew and grew. Then we started running programs to educate reporters about how to write well for the general public using our stuff. And then we created video news releases gave it out there. So when the authors would see, it's kind of nice for somebody to be on the front page of New York Times, maybe we'll consider JAMA, not just New England Journal. Right. Those were among the main ones.
Okay, so this is really building up. JAMA is, you know, flying high. And then, was it January 99?
Yeah.
You get hit with, you're going to get sacked.
Well, I got fired. I had about 2 days' notice, and I didn't go into work the day it happened because my lawyer said, why bother? They're going to sack you anyway. They don't have to do it in person. That was January 15th, 1999.
And that was all related to the Clinton and this whole article that you published. What did you think about what was going on?
Well, I thought it was interesting. I didn't like it because I thought I had the best job in the world, and I wanted to kind of like keep that job. But there had been tensions building, and when you look at it in retrospect, I made it through five different CEOs.
Yeah.
The first one hires you, will you support you? The second one was fantastic, very supportive. And then a third, and then a fourth, and then it got to the point that they didn't have that much invested in me, and they started not liking some of the things I was doing, and having a little confusion with what is editorial freedom, and to what extent should the top people at the AMA control what goes into the journal. And the answer is to none.
Yeah.
They didn't like that. So they were looking for some reason to say, off with his head, and they found it.
So do you think there was anything to this, or this was just a good excuse to say, we had enough of George?
They tried it the previous fall in October, and that isn't well known, but there were efforts that when I was on 60 Minutes on behalf of quality of care and the value of the autopsy in assuring quality of care, there was an effort at that point to get rid of it, but it didn't generate any leverage because everybody said, hey, he did the right thing. There was nothing wrong with that. So that led to, let's look for the next thing.
Right.
And then here comes this next thing, and there's this Clinton impeachment thing going on, and did he perjure himself or not? And and what is the JAMA doing publishing a paper that says, the young people say oral sex isn't sex at all, so maybe there's no perjury, and the Senate trial was ongoing. I didn't seek the paper. It sought us. It went through the proper peer review. It was revised. But I wasn't blind to its journalistic interest.
Sure. Now, what you experience is actually a really important phenomenon in American medicine, and that is the kind of trade guild that is, AMA is representative, but it could be any professional society.
Yes, and it was many.
Right, and in the journal, which is supposed to be autonomous. And the fact, what do you think about these medical societies?
I think they're very important. It's a natural thing for professionals and others to want to group with people of like interest.
Right.
So Stephen Locke once said that once a given group of physicians achieve within a geographic area the number of 500, they form a society.
Okay.
And then they grow, and by the time they achieve 1,000, they've said, we have to have a journal.
Okay.
And they keep doing that. I've been watching that for 30 years, and he's still right.
But the societies, professional societies, their interest is their constituents to make sure that they get paid and reimbursement doesn't get hit, and
medical societies are it's difficult to generalize because there are a lot of different ones. For example, we used to try to get people from our editorial boards to belong to the AMA, and we were told you got to get them try. And I said I refuse to make that a requirement, but we will encourage them to.
Sure.
And I pitched that to pediatricians, and the pediatric journal board members would say, the American Academy of Pediatrics is for kids. The AMA is for docs. I'll belong to this one. I won't belong to that one. So that's partly perception, partly true. But societies reflect the nature of the doctors that go into those fields. So if you look at the American Academy of Family Physicians or PEDS or thereabouts, you're looking at really nice folks who want to do primary
care. So some of them aspire to do the absolute best thing for patients and physicians.
Many do, and they all want to be seen as that.
Well, were you the JAMA editor-in-chief during that whole Sunbeam thing?
I was.
So that's an example, right?
It was so interesting you would bring that up. Yeah, this was one of the many huge mistakes the AMA made.
Yeah.
And that was done through one of these sequence of CEOs became under the influence of the marketing people who sold him on the notion of, well, we can get money for this kind of thing.
Well,
with
Chainsaw
Al Dunlap, who was running Sunbeam back then. This was really bad.
AMA endorses Sunbeam products.
Yeah, it
to
did.
Get money from Sunbeam. Now, what does that have to do with, you know, medicine, advancing the medical profession?
Are you telling me?
No, I'm just saying, but where were they going with this? I mean, didn't
they
realize
it was going to be a disaster? They were going for money because there's big pressure on all medical societies to create revenue in addition to dues revenue.
Right.
Because they all want to keep the dues low, so they have to get money from other things. And they hire staff people from the secular world, and they say, now you're going to have to create schemes to bring money. Shall we co-sponsor Buick, for example? Or maybe we'll get credit cards from one of these awful banks and put our wonderful name on it, and then we'll get a little piece of all those credit card transactions.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff. Or we'll go into real estate.
Yeah. All right. Well, now you leave JAMA and the AMA, and you go to an independent entity, Medscape. Which isn't part of a medical society. It's kind of the new look. It's the web and the community electronic of medical people. And you did that in terms of running the editor role like another decade.
I had a variety of editor jobs there for 10 years.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And you've recently come back to
Michigan. I am. I'm back now as an editor at large.
Yeah, that's great.
A little part-time role.
Okay, that's terrific. What is your experience working in this type of environment as compared to the the more tried and true journal with, you know, the kind of different responsibilities, obviously, in the internet world as compared to the an editor editing role like JAMA.
More similarities than differences. It's still substance. It's still timing. It's still selection of information. It's still working with and through the best people you can find to work with, rewarding them in ways that make sense for them. But it was, the JAMA job was great, but the Medscape job was almost as good. In some ways, it was even better because we were creating the medical internet.
Right.
And we developed the ethics of the medical internet. One of the very first things we did in 1999 was to create the ethics of the medical internet. And that's been the basis for how the whole thing is developed. I'm very, very proud of that.
Yeah, which is terrific. And you're not, you were not beholden to a medical society.
Not at all.
So,
we never did make deals with, well, that's not really true. We did have.
Okay.
We got into the CME. But we created online CME at Medscape right then.
Right.
In 1990. It didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
And you, of course, were in Montreal, more or less, bouncing around doing a lot of other things, but with the heart.org and from around those same times.
Yes.
And then you became part of us at a different time. Not that late, rather earlier. But there was never any effort of interference with editorial concept, process, or content at Medscape. Never, ever. Clean as a whistle. The CME, clean as a whistle. Whenever the dollar type folks would try to whittle away at that, we'd say, no, you can't do that. So there became separations, and separations
right.
that were needed. And that's been really, really wonderful. But anyway, great opportunity. I used to say, see, this was not only Medscape. This was the dot-com boom.
Oh, yeah.
And the dot-com bust.
Right.
And I used to tell some of the people I worked with back then, this is crazy. The only thing I ever lived through that's anything like this before was the Vietnam War. It was that confusing. But
right.
I knew there would be survivors and there would be a lot that weren't.
Yeah.
Medscape survived, thrived, and has prevailed.
Well, we certainly like to think that we're going to continue to build on what you and so many others have done in the earlier years of Medscape. Now, you recently had your 80th birthday, big party.
I did.
And you're still going strong.
Well,
what do you think going forward? What's the plan?
I actually have more people and groups asking me to do stuff now than I did, except for when I was fired from JAMA. That was such a high-profile firing that I had 14 job offers within a week.
That's pretty good.
I thought it was good, and I selected carefully, and I did the right thing, it turned out. But now I don't have that kind of activity, but I have lots of stuff going on, including startups contacting for advice on this, advice on that. Maybe you do a little bit of this.
So you need a lot of stimulation, right?
I don't know if need is the right word. I enjoy it.
I enjoy it. I mean, yeah.
I've been blessed with good health.
Yeah,
I've taken care of myself, and I've done a lot of prevention over the years and had not too aggressive medical interventions for anything that didn't need it, because then you get into a whole lot more trouble.
Right.
So I think careful prevention and my brain, the viewers will be able to figure out whether it's working or not, but I feel like it's working pretty well. So
I think a lot of creativity coming along.
I don't
think there's any concern about that one. Now, I had a couple other questions for you. Obviously, American medicine is pretty messed up. It's an economic crisis. Lots of solutions have been proffered out there. What do you think would be the single thing that would help to get American medicine on track?
The recognition by the rank and file American that they should follow Norton Hadler's newest book, basically, which is called Citizen Patient, and take charge of the healthcare system as citizens so that we have consumer-driven healthcare, which also has payers that report to the consumers in reasonable ways with reasonable regulation. Clearly, there's no other one system in the world that we should have. We're a big, complicated country. Lots of people, lots of diversity, lots of conflict, almost multiple countries within one country.
Yeah.
So if we had a small place like Switzerland or the Netherlands, their systems are probably the best. The Singapore system is good. Taiwan has a wonderful system. So there are many systems. Both of my sons married Japanese women, so I have 5 Japanese-American grandchildren. And one of my daughters-in-law uses the healthcare system in Japan a lot, unfortunately, but it's wonderful. Great care, very happy with it. If she has, she says it's the most expensive thing there in going to the doctor is the parking.
Okay.
So there are ways to do it right.
I'm into that, this consumer-driven movement. I think that's terrific. Now, last question for you. Of all the things that you've done through this career, academic, pathology, you know, a very long tenure at JAMA, and then, of course, really a pioneer in the Internet of Medicine, so many things. I can't even enumerate them. What do you think is the thing that you're most proud of? What do you think is the thing that, you know, when you're 110, you'll look back and say, this was it?
Staying power.
Okay.
Ability to adapt. Multiple careers, all related but all different. Getting in there and working hard and getting results.
Well, that's very inspiring. And I think that a lot of our physicians, they'll like hearing that. Because there's a lot of challenges that lie ahead, and the ability to have plasticity and adapt is going to be central. So that's great. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We really are delighted to have the first editor-in-chief of Medscape with us today to give us some of his not only backgrounds and insights, but wisdom. And we'll look forward to having some more interesting, very interesting people in the medical domain to join us on these Medscape one-on-ones in the future. Thanks so much for your attention.